If we haven't met before, my name is Reb Bradley, and I'll introduce a couple things about myself to help you understand where I'm coming from. We have our six children are ranging in age from 32 down to 16. And so we've homeschooled them all. But we've done different kinds of homeschooling, just different kinds of schooling, actually, variety of approaches here and there. But I'm not somebody who's done everything right in parenting. In fact, that's why I'm here. That's why I am sharing this session with you, because I have found that there are many people like myself who don't like to make the mistakes when it involves your kids. And so I have made some mistakes in our parenting, but more than just my own life, I pastored a church for many years that I had planted that was about 500 people. About 90% were homeschoolers up in the Sacramento area. And I retired about 6.5, 7 years ago. But I had a front row seat to watching children grow up from birth to the time they were married. There were children who I was there when they were born and now are married. I watched the whole spread. I watched kids grow up, their whole year of homes, all the years of homeschooling, on into graduate into life. So I have a front row seat, not to mention my travels around the country. And the reason I do this session, I call it Solving the Crisis in Homeschooling, is because many of us, as our kids age, those of us who are over 50 particularly, were shocked at the results. You homeschool because you imagine there's going to be a certain outcome. And what we began to discover around the country was that the kids who were so promising, the perfect kids, the kids you say, this is the poster child for homeschooling, they would grow up and shock their parents by going astray. Now, they might not forsake Christ, but they might shock their parents by secretly marrying a childhood sweetheart the parents didn't know they even had. I'm giving you true stories here. I mean, shocking them by becoming an atheist. This is I'm thinking one kid was an Eagle Scout, and he was outstanding, read the Bible every day, and first year of college became an atheist. Stunning, shocking, the parents who didn't anticipate this. How can this be? We're dedicated parents. We're giving ourselves to homeschooling. We, of all the people that are out there, should not see our kids going up and going astray. But as I begin to evaluate it, I begin to see that actually, by the way, our style of parenting, we as parents can actually increase the likelihood our kids will go astray. And what I want to lay out for you are the blind spots we can have as homeschoolers that increases the likelihood our kids are going to grow up and say, I want nothing to do with this. And so it's not our dedication. It's simply we have some blind spots. And I want to show you what those blind spots are today. So let's follow along with the outline. The problem basically is this. Many conscientious parents are watching their kids grow up and abandon their values. That's the answer to number one. Abandon their values. And it's happening all over. And some of you are listening, you have your own opinions and thoughts, and you're going to be weighing out what I say against your opinions and thoughts. And who knows, maybe you're right, maybe we're going to agree. The bottom line is basically this, we have blind spots. Now, if some of you think, I don't have blind spots, that's what a blind spot is. If you could see it, it wouldn't be a blind spot. Some of you are thinking, but I see all my blind spots. Oh, if that's you, you're going to have a rough time. Listen, I just find it's easier to stop pretending and say, you know, maybe there's something I don't see. These are our kids. Our pride isn't worth saying, no, I'm right. It's not worth it. It's worth it saying, if I'm doing something, contributing in some way, that's going to increase the likelihood that my kids are going to grow up and want to abandon the values that I'm trying to give them, I want to see it. Because I am a homeschooler diehard. I do believe this is the optimum way to influence and raise our children. So there is a way, and there must be a way, to homeschool our children, not have them grow up and say, I want no part of this. No, we don't want our kids to abandon the values. Now, I'm going to give you the 7 blind spots. We're going to look at them. They're numbered on your outline, or lettered as A, B, C. But basically, those are going to be the 7 blind spots. I'm going to give you the solutions. Now, what I'm also doing for you right now is giving you the first session of a 4-session homeschool seminar that I present for homeschoolers. But it's the first session. So my answers will be concise at the end, and they'll be simple, but I won't be able to develop all the solutions because it's going to take us a while to get through the blind spot. So let's look. Let's jump in. Roman numeral 2 on your outlines. Blind spot number 1. Ready? Here it is. We become focused on success as homeschool parents. We become focused on our success. You see, there's nothing wrong with endeavoring to do anything and want to be successful. You mow the lawn, you want the lawn to get cut. You don't want to finish and say, oh, I forgot to engage the blades. You want to mow the lawn. You want to invest your life. Come on, you ladies, some of you could be in careers. Your money could be double in the household, but you've chosen to live a simpler life so that your kids could have the optimum education, that you could protect them and shelter them from various things out there and pour into them the what is really important. You want to be successful in this endeavor. Nothing wrong with that, but listen to, I phrase it carefully. We become focused, poignantly, we over-focused on our success. But get this, our personal success. Here's how I realized I had that problem. My oldest son, we had six kids, as I say. Oldest son, the firstborn, all the pressures on that first one. I'm a pastor speaking, writing on parenting and family. Great pressure my kids lived under to be perfect at all times, especially in public. Poor guys. He's 18 years old, and ultimately he'd lost his desire to speak respectfully. In our home, it's just a requirement to be respectful as you would be in the place of employment or in the military. If you wanted to talk back to Dad, all you had to say is, Dad, may we talk about this? Or, Dad, may I try to convince you otherwise? Or, Dad, I think there's information you don't have. Can I give it to you? All reasonable. Get my attention. But our son had lost the motivation to do that and was just saying, but, Dad, and he started talking back. Finally, after him, he wasn't correcting, and I said, you have 3 weeks to change that, or you can't live here anymore, setting a bad example for your brothers and sisters. And so within 3 weeks, I got his stuff, and I put it in the porch. Now, mind you, he was in college. He was on the football team, spring training at American River College. And I got his stuff and put it in the front porch. Now, my son is huge. He's 6'5", 350 pounds, huge fellow, eventually became a cop. By that time, he was having a lot of fun on the football team. It was great because he could smash people and destroy them and be patted on the back instead of getting in trouble. He liked that. He'd waited his whole life for this moment. So he's on the football team. Now, this big, huge guy starts weeping. Dad, please, no. Son, I've given you 3 weeks. You can't live here anymore. So basically, he called a friend up from the football team. He went, moved out. And it was a heartbreaking day. We wept because we had dreams for our children. We had dreams, and he would stay at home. He would go to college. He'd be something. He'd get a career, and under a carefully orchestrated courtship process, would one day meet and marry and march off down the aisle into the beauty and glory of heaven on earth because he's a homeschool graduate. And we had it all figured out. And now I looked at him, and I said, son, you ruined my dreams. Do you see the tip-off? My dream to being successful included a variable, him. See, my dream was for a human. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with having dreams for your kids, but the bottom line was, my dream for him was really about me being successful. It was about my pride. He had messed up my dream. I wasn't just weeping, what have you done to yourself? It was, what have you done to me? You see, here's the bullet under A. Our dreams for our kids really end up being our dreams for us and our success as parents. Our success, maybe you recognize the Duggar family. I don't mean to, I'm not saying they're failed in some way. I'm just saying they're the epitome of what homeschooling theoretically can be. You know, 95 children, and they all play musical instruments, and it's astonishing. I've met the family, and I can't say as I know them well, but we dream for our kids. But our dreams are really about us and our success. Come on, anybody who invests themselves in something, wants to be a success in it. But that's the first start. We're sacrificing a lot to get results in our children so we can feel successful. I don't know your heart. I can't say that's your heart or every homeschooler's heart. I'm saying that's the first blind spot. If we fall in this category, our dreams for our children are really about us feeling successful. And our kids, get this, are incidental because they're part of our dream. Blind spot number two, letter B. Preoccupation with results can turn the family into a measurement of success. You got that? We can become so focused on results, now our family is the measurement or proof of our success. Have you ever seen a group of guys
at a, outside of Dunkin' Donuts kind of a place, and they're on a Saturday morning, and they've all got their cars lined up, their car guys. And they're all sitting back looking at their cars and talking about it. I've been walking by and wiping the bird dew off, if any got on it. They will notice those guys never park their cars under trees. They don't want the bird dew. And they're lined up and they're talking about their cars and the hand-carved mahogany toggle switches and whatever else they've got on their vehicle and how their engine, the air cleaner is set up. It's like they're showing off their stuff. Sometimes homeschoolers, that can happen. You gather, it's like, be on your best behavior, don't humiliate me, don't embarrass me, because I will kill you when we get home. Praise the Lord. And so you're in a gathering, we got their homeschoolers. Now mind you, it's not like a convention where you have your kids. If you're pastoring a church, it's 90% homeschoolers. So you all gather on Sundays and everybody has to be, oh yes, we're together, we're perfect, thank you. Thank you. Notice my children all dress alike, they all have the matching denim, blue denim jumpers. And you might notice in it's, there were families in my church who were so proud of it. Their kids were trained to a snap. Dad would walk down to their row, snap his fingers. Sons, daughters would line up, and in unison, they'd all sit. One mom, I remember walking, her children huddled around her at a measured 18-inch circle. Wherever she moved, they moved in unison with her. But there's nothing wrong with having children respond and stay within a distance from parents. I'm not knocking, but I'm saying is our children validate us. They can if it's a blind spot. You see, number one, the family can become a trophy, or biblically, more accurately, an idol. They are what prove we've done something. And that's why we get angry. Don't humiliate me. Wait a second. If the child misbehaves at home, they need correction. But if they misbehave in public, suddenly, you're furious. The pressure you put on them. You see, number two, our children become for us a means of feeling successful. They're our means. It's how we succeed. But you know what begins to happen? The kids feel it because they're incidental. And the relationship that you need to influence them through their teen years, it breaks down. It's important that we understand that our pride in our children, especially if we're homeschoolers, can be the death of them. They'll feel it. They're our validation. Number three, we've got to remember this point too, that our highest success is not measured by the effect we have upon others, i.e. our children, but our obedience to the Lord. And yet, there are some who are convinced, you're proving that I'm spiritual. You're proving that I'm a good parent. You're proving that I've read it. I'm carrying out all the books I've consumed. You're proving it outwardly. You're the fruit of what I'm doing. You're validating me. See, that's a wrong concept. When I planted our church years ago, Richard and Sabina Wormbrand came to visit. And if you're familiar with him, he was tortured for many years in communist prison camps, Romania. He and his wife were just, they're astonishing. It's like they've had the world beat out of them. And all they know left is Jesus is wonderful. They've both been tortured. And so I'm giving Sabina a ride. Now, mind you, they're both in heaven now. They're both aging people. And Sabina says to me, how is the church plant going? And I said, well, I believe I'm in obedience to the Lord to be here planting the church. So I anticipate the church will be a success. To which she rebuked me. She says, obedience is the highest success. I wanted to say, I knew that. But I was thinking my obedience was going to produce a big, thriving, successful church. And her point was, now mind you, you listen to someone who's been tortured for Jesus. You listen to someone who's had the wounds and injuries of years of torture in communist prison camps. And they look at you and say something like this, you pay attention. And she says, obedience is the highest success. In other words, success isn't that your church will be big and thriving. And I realized, you know, a good marketing expert and program organized guy with a good talker, he can make a big church. No, obedience is the success. And if you're the fruit of your ministry is you have obedient congregation, that's further demonstration. But still, our calling is to sow and water. God gives the increase. Sow into your children's life. Water into their life. But they're not dogs. A dog you could train, and it'll be trained the rest of its life. Yeah, a little reinforcement. But children are not dogs. They're not animals. You train them, but they ultimately grow up and decide, what am I going to do with the training I've received? Now, if you have the dog perspective on your children, it'll create this overbearing sense of domination that I'm talking about here. Let's keep moving. So the second blind spot is the family becomes your validation for success. And your children feel it. Relationship starts to break down. Number three, blind spot. Preoccupation with results then leads to emphasis on outward form. In other words, you're thinking in terms of how are people thinking I'm doing? How are others perceiving me? I want them to think I'm doing well. So you guys, how you dress, how you adorn yourself, your hairstyle is going to make a huge impact. Therefore, we begin to focus on adornment, clothes, makeup, hair, you name it. What your kids do, whether they get a tattoo or don't get a tattoo, whether they have piercings of the ears or nose or something else. I mean, we're in an interesting age. I travel the nation, and so I interact with churches all over. I've been in churches that are like thug churches. They're all saved thugs and motorcycle gang members. And they have their obscene tattoos turned into Christian tattoos. And you sit there and the pastor's got tattoos. I mean, in other words, it's not the measuring stick for their faith is if they have a tattoo or piercings in body parts. Yet in the culture many of us come from, more conservative than that, that would be frightening, the thought that somebody would have tattoos. So we get consumed with our externals, with our children. And I asked a pastor once who has 10 kids. I said, how is it your kids are so stellar? And yet, I visited your church, and I would have guessed that all the kids in your church were so stellar because I watched them that Sunday I visited, and every teenager in that church was taking notes when the pastor was preaching. And they sat there so reserved, so restrained, and so diligent to take notes. And he says, well, the church isn't what you'd think. We have a number of out-of-wedlock pregnancies, and those are normal kids, you might. I would never guess that from seeing. He says, well, here's what happened. When I came into the church, he says, and my 10 kids were there, and my kids take notes when I preach, but I never told them to. We simply have poured Christ into our kids, and when they show up on Sunday, they just don't want to miss what I say, and so they take notes. I don't tell them to. But other parents looked at that and said, do you see what the pastor's kids are doing? You're going to take notes. And everybody began to train their children because they like the fruit born. That'd be like you seeing your neighbor's tree full of apples, and you say to your wife, honey, our tree doesn't have apples on it. Go to the store. Buy some. We're going to tie them on. So in the dead of night, you tie all these apples on your tree. Next morning, you go out to water your lawn just so you can watch people look over the fence at your tree. Of course, they're going to be rotten in about 4 weeks. That's not fruit that's going to last. But that's what it's like. Here's what happens is, number one, we emulate the fruit of those who appear successful in their training. You see, oh, do you see how they're dressing? Do you see how they're adorning themselves? Oh, that's what conservative is. I see. And so we start emulating that of those of people around here. But here's what happens. We end up molding our kids' behavior and miss their hearts. Because the emphasis external. There's nothing wrong with modesty. I want my daughters, I want my wife, I want girls to be modest. I want this. But remember what I'm saying. We emphasize the externals. It's like that's the proof of your Christianity is your faith. Went to a church, were they even saved? You see the way those women dressed? We mold our kids' behavior. We emphasize it. So think about it. You're a child growing up at home. What is your Christianity about you're seeing from your parents? It's about how you appear, how you look. And you can tell if you're emphasizing the outside to your kids because your kids come home and to make you happy, they say things like, did you see the way they were dressed? Did you see what they were wearing? I don't think they've heard the right seminars. Are they really saved, Mom? You go, oh, sure, it's possible. Some people are just naive and they don't understand that denim is a requirement. Or whatever it's going to be. My wife looks good in her denim skirt. But is that the measurement of her homeschooling? Or do you have to own one just to be a homeschooler? It has to be in the closet? I don't know. We mold our kids' behavior, though, and we miss their hearts. Their hearts are what we have to shape. See, this pastor poured into his kids, and the fruit of it was they loved the word. They loved to hear their dad preach, and they took notes. He was doing it right. Everybody else just said, I like that fruit, and they tied that fruit on their kids. Do you see the difference? Here's a classic illustration. Okay, if you're not familiar with it, my book, Child Training Tips, many of you perhaps have it. If not, you need it. Another topic. But because we were a church known for strengthening families, so many homeschoolers and the like, people would sometimes move in from another city or another across the country and join us, be part of this utopian fellowship of homeschoolers, you know. And they would testify about how they came. And I remember this family had just moved from San Jose to us in Sacramento and had stood up when they testified being there and enjoying the fruit of the book and the other things. And I remember meeting their son afterwards, and he walked up to me and he says, "Hey, hi, Reb." And I thought to myself, "Ooh, not Mr. Bradley? Your parents must have missed that chapter on respect, huh?" I said to myself, and in my mind, get this, I belittled them because he didn't call me Mr. Bradley. I'm not a peer. You know, I'm an adult. He called first name, not a first name basis. So you do your friends. It all worked out. It's all in the book. They missed that chapter, and I belittled them in my mind. Get this, I was mistaken. You see, in the Bible, there's no one who said Mr. and Mrs. It was just Paul. There wasn't Apostle Paul. Kids called adults without a title. I see it as a reasonable teaching to in an age where loss of respect happens for those who are older. So I still encourage Mr. and Mrs. and my children. However, I miss this guy's heart. This kid meant no disrespect. He loved me and respected me. And when he said, "Hi, Reb," he just didn't know my trick. Do you know how many parents I know who overheard him and thought, "Who is this new family? Letting their kid call somebody by a first name basis?" They don't have a clue. The belittling that was going on. 6 months later, I really knew who the kid was, and I said, "I've made a serious mistake." Without naming their name, I stood up in front of the church, and I owned it and apologized if I had ever caused that anybody else. To value external stuff. We mold our kids' behavior. We emphasize this. Maybe you find yourself sitting in church, and somebody's got a squawking baby, and you think, "Why don't they take the kid out? They need some parenting help. You don't have to let your kids make that kind of noise. That's not a toddler. I mean, it's not a baby. That's a toddler. They can be trained. You've got it all worked out. You're frustrated with them because they don't know." Some of you are listening thinking, "Oh, I guess that's me then they're frustrated with." That's not the point. The point is that there are those of us who will sit in chairs or in church in a pew and think, "Why don't somebody do something about that kid?" We're taking pride in the fact we know what to do, and we've done it with our perfectly frozen fish stick kids. Afraid to move. When the pastor preaches, they won't even draw. They will only write English words that look like they're taking notes. They're frozen. They're just because we know how to do it. What would Jesus do? Would he sit in the front of this lady with a squawking kid? And think belittling thoughts? Or is that pride? That's condescension. You see, you've elevated the wrong thing. What's the heart of God would be to stand up and say, "Can I help you with your little one? Want me to hold her? I'll just step right off the sign." Which a stranger might not release their child to you, but unless they were really desperate and say, "Take her." The point, though, is that the condescension, the arrogance in our heart, because we've emphasized getting children in order, sitting still in church. "Oh, those kids, can they be saved? Their hair touches their ears." That I remember going to a missionary school my daughter went to when she was 20. She went on the mission field. She went to the training institute first. One of the kids there had clown red hair. And my first, this was, you know, 10 plus years ago, I thought, he's got to be saved to get in here. And I eventually got to know that guy, had him in my home. He was earnest, but he was from a culture within the community where clown red hair wasn't that bizarre. Or just what you did as a teenager, you just did stuff and you changed the color of your hair. And before he went in the mission field, the mission required him to make his hair normal or cut it off. Because he figured out it would alienate people who didn't get it. But it didn't occur to him coming even to this missionary school that there might be parents who thought, "What's with this kid?" My point is just simply this. Do we take pride in the fact our kids have neat, conservatively groomed hair? What are we emphasizing? External stuff? Our kids aren't in a youth group? Our kids dress modestly? We don't have a TV? What is it we're elevating to be these things, these standards? See, these are proof of our spirituality. Fourth blind spot, letter D. Preoccupation with the outward brings with it, get this, a tendency to judge others by our standards. I remember a lady once judging others whose kids didn't sit respectfully enough. In fact, this lady, God bless her, wrote a letter to our church to expose the horrible failure of a father I was. She says, "Oh, I just can't keep it to myself anymore. We sit behind the Bradleys at church, and on Sunday morning, one Sunday, here's the main thing. I'm not exaggerating. Here's the main thing. Their son rolled up his notes into a tube and looked at his father through it." I thought to myself, wow. If I'd seen him doing that, I would have done it back at him. It never crossed my mind to teach my children, don't look at me through rolled up tubes. But the parents were so proud of the fact that their children would sit so cordially, so respectfully, and I could count on every Sunday they'd come up to me and say, thank you, Pastor Bradley, that was a wonderful sermon. They would do it every Sunday like robots, and yet I knew in the home their kids fought like wild animals. In other words, but the mom was so proud of what she'd worked in that she was judging me and belittling me. And the second thing she came up with was, and one Sunday, Reb's daughter cleaned out her purse during the sermon. What she didn't know is my daughter was actually looking for a pen so she could take notes and was putting everything back orderly. But so what? I wouldn't have a problem. My daughter cleaned out her purse while she listened to me. That's not an issue. But to this lady, she'd focused on, there's my standard of holiness, and Reb's children don't achieve it. It's missing the point, isn't it? That's what happens, though, when we major on our things. Whatever our things are, we'll judge others. We judge both parents and children by the areas, get this, in which we feel successful. We feel successful in an area. And she felt successful in this tiny little area, how to behave during a church service. And so she judged others. Folks, this is so far away from the heart of God. Is this what you want to bring your children up in? Well, you're so proud of, they know how to do it. And so proud of the fact they're faithful. They're in the choir and they attend potlucks. And you don't. Like, that's the measurement of your spirituality. So what happens is, number one under D, we major on the minors. These minor things, the baby crying in the church. We don't have a TV. We belittle the pastor. We walk into the home of our pastor and say, not only does he have a TV, he has satellite. Can we sit under this man's teaching? Now, mind you, I'm somebody who's had problems with TV, and so we haven't had television for 20 years or something like that, because I had the biggest problem watching it. You know, we actually got it in December for a short time because my wife's dad was visiting and he needed to see it, needed to have TV. And we ended up leaving it on for a while. And so I can't say as we haven't had television. We've had it for a short season. But it was kind of interesting. It desensitized my children. They used to be fascinated. Growing up at home without TV, they would be fascinated they'd see it. Any place. But now, it's no big deal. My point isn't to talk about it. The point is to say we major on the minors. Here's the things that we don't do. Here's all the stuff we avoid. Here's all the stuff we don't listen to or watch. Here's the kind of haircuts I don't get. We major on these minor things. You know what happens, though, with judgment? You can tell you're in a judgment state of mind, maybe circle of friends, because you're always defensive and always embarrassed. In other words, let's just say you're in a circle of people who think it's unspiritual to have a television. So you want to tell them a story. And so you're with your friends and you're saying, you know, I was in Sears the other day and on the television there. So you have to clarify, it wasn't at home. It was in Sears, and you're walking past the TV section. And so you know you're with judges because you offer disclaimers. I still do it habitually in case somebody's judging me who's listening to me. You know, when I had to explain that disclaimer, what's that about? That there's this innate part of me that doesn't want to be judged or something, I suppose. The judgment comes, defensiveness, embarrassment, you're afraid you'll be embarrassed. And sure enough, you're imagining they're going to judge you, and one of your friends says to you, well, that's why we don't even go in Sears. Because we might see television. You can't get away from it, folks. Preoccupation with the outside brings focus on judging others by our standards. It's interesting that the Pharisees, not Jesus, who were preoccupied with outward holiness, they were emphasizing it. Now, on your sheets, I put a lot of scriptures to look up. For time's sake, we can't go through them all. But I want to lay this out. I remember a man telling me that you can always tell the depth of a Christian's spirituality by how modestly their women dressed in their home. Or rather, the wives and daughters, when they're in public. That was his measurement. I'm thinking to myself, that's interesting. And one night I read 5 hours, spent reading through the Gospels, looking for everything Jesus said on modesty. When I got all done, I said, that's fascinating. He never addressed modesty. He hung out with prostitutes, ex-prostitutes, loose women, and never, in the sight, he says, by the way, try to, you know, dress more modestly, ladies. You're going to hang out with me. Got some guys around here. You're a stumble, you let your skirts go all the way to the ground and drag, no ankles, please. There was none of that. No reference to it. Now, it's on the heart of God. Therefore, in 1 Timothy chapter 2, it says, let women dress modestly. One place, it's on the heart of God. It's there. And yet, this, I've heard people elevate it to the place of spirituality. It's like part of the gospel. You can tell the people saved by the way they dress. What a wrong perspective. Let's clean up the outside of the cup. Folks, I want to say it and emphasize it. It's not Jesus, it's the Pharisees. And he kept coming against the Pharisees because they were always emphasizing avoiding bad stuff. What kid ever says, I can't wait till I can grow up and avoid bad stuff? Do you wonder why our children grow up in homeschool homes or Christian homes and then they forsake those values? Because that was the essence of the Christianity, was about all the stuff you avoided. Is that what 90% of your parenting is? All the stuff you avoid and abstain from? Jesus' approach was this in Matthew 23:26. He says, Pharisees, you're blind. Clean the inside of the cup and then the outside will be clean as well. Invest in the heart and then watch the heart bear fruit. I remember thinking to myself, wow, look at those new, when I was a college student, these gals showed up at church I was visiting. They looked like they were streetwalkers. You know, painted faces, they're all dressed up like they were going to go spend an evening on the street as hookers. And I come to find out they'd gotten saved that week, and they were saved hookers, and that's how they thought you dressed up for church. But I was judging them. Well, okay, they're saved now? Well, they better clean up their acts. Somebody tell them what real modesty is. Jesus' approach is invest in the heart and watch it bear fruit. Keep investing in your children. And yes, you know what? I do tell my daughters, or I say, honey, here's what a man would look upon as a sexually provocative, and here's how I ask you, therefore, that you dress based on what men might do. I coach them about values and all these kinds. I want to pour into their hearts. So yeah, I want my girls to be modest. But invest in their heart, primarily your children, and watch the fruit be born, just like my pastor friend did. 10 kids, and acquainting them with Jesus and his wonder and his beauty, and they came to church and they took notes without being told to. Do you see the difference between, let's just clean up the outside? The Pharisees were preoccupied with what to do. Jesus was emphasizing who to be. They wanted to know, what do we do? What are the externals? How do we clean up? Just tell me the process, and we'll do the thing. She says, no, it's about who you actually are. Change the heart. Work in the heart between you and God, and then watch what happens on the outside. Just watch what occurs. Here's the next thing, the steps, this in our step along in this path. Blind spot number 5, letter E. We develop a false security in our ability to control our children or our families. Get this, I'll say it, and I've worded it very carefully. We develop a false security in our ability to control. I did. I was sure I was controlling the influences of my children's life. I'm controlling them. It was all about me directing, me determining what they needed to do, what they needed to avoid. I was sure that this place of authority in my life would disappear, because I wrote a booklet on it once, an irrefutable biblical book on parental authority, adult children, which I no longer sell. I burned every copy of it I could find when I realized how imbalanced it made me and others. But I had this picture that one day, as my children get ready to march down the aisle after their carefully orchestrated and controlled courtship process, that they would walk, march down the aisle with to be married. And as they started on that aisle, I would slowly release the grip because I was going to keep them in the shape I wanted them to be in up until their wedding day. And I'd slowly take my fingers off. And then they would march slowly down the aisle, keeping that shape until they said, I do. And they would march off into their life, having been controlled into that shape by their father. That's me. That's what I did. Or I thought I was on the path to doing. Praise God, he rescued us before we went all the way. Because actually the rescuing comes the fact you see your adult kids, they're not dogs. You can't control them. They're individuals who will decide, what am I going to do with my life? I saw it was an impossible kind of thinking. So we developed the security and our ability to control. I've had people say, you had to kick your son out? Well, you shouldn't be a pastor then. If your adult son made a choice that was wrong and he was out, because our son was out of our house for 4 months and he was 18. A pastor, and I said, how old are your children? He said, well, my oldest is 9. I said, God bless you. Call me in about 10 years. I'll be your friend. I'm your friend now. But you're going to discover you don't have control, that they grow up with a will of their own, a thought of their own, they're self-determining, and they will decide, what am I going to do? If that means you're a failure because your adult children make choices that are contrary to the values you sought to give them, then God's in trouble. Because he poured himself into Israel as his children, and Israel ultimately rejected them how many times? Then God's a failure. No, God pours into it all, granting to us, the sovereign God, who has all power to do all things, yet still ultimately our responsibility as individuals is to make choices, to follow. He holds us responsible for those choices. Get this in mind. Number one under E, when we rely on our authority to intimidate teens, gains us only outward compliance. You can control very small children. In fact, that's an important part of parenting, is keeping them under your control. They become teenagers, however. Intimidating them gains outward compliance. Intimidating a teenager means this. The dominant means of motivating them is threat of consequence. That's what I'm talking about. If that's in your home, you're on the path to failure right now. If the chief way you have of getting your 16-year-old in line is to say, listen, if you don't do such and such, here's the consequence. You understand me? No, there's times like that you have to warn someone. If you make these choices, here'll be the consequences. But if the chief and dominant means you're always trying to influence your teenagers to do right and to toe the line, you're going to lose them. That's what I've been doing this for years. It's not possible to intimidate them this way by threat of consequence. You get compliance, outward compliance. You're missing their hearts, however. You can intimidate them into subjection, but you're going to fail to win their hearts into submission. There's a big difference. My wife and I used to think we had our oldest kids' hearts. We didn't. We had to learn there's a difference between affection and having their hearts. We had our kids' affections. They loved us. They touched us. They hung on us. We were warm. We were touching. That's not having their hearts. Having their hearts means they respond to your leadership and respect you and seek to obey you out of love and respect. That's having their hearts when they're away from you as well as right there. I've known some parents who were shocked because the kids just learned to patronize the parents. We'll just comply. We'll go with the program. Don't rock the boat. When mom, dad speak, say, yes, mom, yes, dad. Yes, mom, yes, dad. And do it. Parents who are stunned at 17, 18, their kids just take a hike. They leave. See, intimidation can merely foster self-preservation. Okay, I don't want to get in trouble. I've seen what happened to my older brother. I'm just going to go along. I'm just going to comply. So what's the first word in self-preservation? Self. You foster a greater love of self. Self-preservation isn't good if that's all you're appealing to in them. So number two, another reason we can get messed up with this area of control is we misunderstand Proverbs 22:6. Train up a child in the way he should go. When he is old, he will not depart from it. So we think, okay, I'm going to control you. Some parents lose the oldest and they get tougher on the younger ones, not realizing that'll force them out. You see, it's not about intimidation and control. Here's what I did once. About 7 years ago, I actually stopped and began to study, how did Solomon do this? My little son at the time was probably 24, out of the house. He was married. But I'm thinking, how did Solomon do it? So I actually studied through Proverbs to see his parenting approach, what he did and what he didn't do. And I was astonished by the way he related with his teenage sons, the way he didn't domineer and control and exercise authority over them. Everything was about coming alongside of them like his fellow adults, appealing to them to do what was right based on wisdom and consequences in their life, their choices. I was fascinated that, but I began to click with me, the Jewish mindset was you were an adult at 13. So they stopped relating, and he as a parent stopped relating with his kids like he was the dominant boss, but appealed to them to make wise choices for their life. And yet, my perspective of this passage, Proverbs 22:6, was I'll get tougher and more controlling to make sure there's an outcome. He saw the outcome would be achieved by mutual respect for them as a young adult, making wise choices. Hey, my family's bearing the fruit of it. I'm enjoying my youngest two because I'm watching my oldest three, actually my oldest four. I was making the mistakes of being the domineering, controlling one. And it's a delight to have my two children who we have such enjoying, such a camaraderie in the Lord together. And to know, my son says, why would I? He looks at his older brother like, I'm not going to do anything like that. I don't want to leave home. I want to stay here. This makes sense to me to go to college. But because I'm not alienating him the way I did my older two. There's such a difference. It's not about dominance control. Blind spot number six. We develop a false confidence in sheltering. I believe your outlines might say, do we develop an overdependence on sheltering? It's the same kind of a thing. It's a false confidence. I call it lazy parenting sometimes. It's lazy parenting. It's just easier to say no. You don't have time to study it, research it. Can you do such and such? You do want to do what? No. That's it. No. No explanation. It's all right. I'm in charge. You're done. No. It was just easy for me to do it. But I studied everything. I researched. I figured out that Mary Poppins was a white witch. Therefore, we couldn't have any. We couldn't do the Smurfs in our home. No cartoons. No. I had everything figured out. All these things. And I didn't preach and teach on it so much, but because I just felt it was more of a personal thing for my family. But the Bradley home was characterized by sheltering. No, that's why no TV. No, you know, you can't play with neighborhood friends. You can't even play with all the people at church. I know they all homeschool. I know. But they don't all share our values. I had this false confidence. In fact, I didn't want to take him into the video store when we're going to rent a parent-approved, healthy, edifying video because they might see video covers that were provocative. I mean, just I was sure I didn't want to take him into Walmart. Because the underwear ads are, you're with your sons and you're in the grocery store checkout line and all these immodest women there, I want to put my hands over their eyes and scoot by this way because they're both taller than me. We developed this false confidence, though, in our sheltering. I was sure. Here's what I used to say. I'm controlling the influences of my children's life, so I'm going to control the outcome. It doesn't take into account they're just fleshly sinners and can discover sin all on their own. Remember reading about a family whose kids had all been involved with incest with each other, and the parents were writing saying, how could this be? We live in the mountains. They're not even around anyone. We church by ourselves. They have no contact with the world. But the parents said, we've done it all right. I make my own bread. I grind my own wheat. We grow our own wheat. And our kids are sinners? How did this happen? You see, it wasn't about sheltering. These parents were putting all their eggs in one basket, if you will. They're depending upon, we're protecting them. And these poor kids are now involved with all kinds of junk. Because I've concluded this, it's not about what you keep from your kids as much as it's what you put into your kids. Oh, hear me. It's not so much about what you keep them from, but what you put in to them. For our kids, if we're majoring on sheltering, Christianity becomes mostly about avoiding negative influences. And is that what is going to attract them to Jesus? Is that what's going to make them say, I want to follow this Savior into eternity? No. It's all about avoiding bad stuff, avoiding negative influences. False reliance and overconfidence and sheltering is going to mess you up. And it gives, get this, sheltering, listen to this phrase carefully, sheltering does nothing to give character. It doesn't. All it does is keep something flammable away from a heat source. But it doesn't give anything character. It doesn't prepare them for their future. It's not giving them character. And you say, but we read the Bible and we have Christian curriculum, and that's good. I don't have to weigh out your home. I'm not evaluating your place. You decide. Am I predominantly relying upon sheltering and protection? My son said to me once, he's 17 now, when he was 8, he says, why do you take me into Walmart? All those women in underwear on the walls. Son, you're going to find that more places than Walmart, women wear underwear. We can't just keep you out of those stores the rest of your life, and you can't avoid it. We want you to be able to look and look away. Son, here's what I do. I pray for women who are immodest. I say, Lord, keep them pure. Lord, keep them modest. I don't stare at them and pray that. I look away and pray. The Lord, keep them modest. Keep them pure for their husband. Get them saved, Lord. Bring them to church. Not my church, but somebody's church. So I coach my sons how to, because at some point they're going to have the strength to do it. Let's keep going. Blind spot number 7. Over-reliance on control easily leads to a formulaic approach to parenting. And this is the key, folks. For this over-reliance on our control and our sheltering and our authority can lead to this formulaic approach to parenting. And formulaic meaning all about methods and formulas. You see, what we do, the first bullet under G, we look for and we rely upon biblical, reliable formulas, methods, and self-working Bible principles. We just want them. I went to the seminars. I read the books. Show me the steps. Show me the ingredients. I was sure that I could, I mix in this big bowl of homeschooling. I mix in conservative dress, you know, modesty and sheltering, and I have it all figured out that I'm going to put it in the oven and set the timer, and ding, at 18, the timer's going to go off, and I'm going to have a perfect angel food kid because I'm mixing in all the ingredients necessary. It's like I came home with new parenting processes and tricks. I went to parenting seminars. I'd written my own book. People would say to me, why are you going to the seminar? You've got the best book around, they tell me. And I don't think it's the best. I want to learn. I want to learn more. I want to learn more tricks. I want to learn more steps, many things I'm not doing. I want to have all the answers because I've got kids at home. But there's a problem with this whole perspective. We're looking upon formulas, techniques. Where's God in the mix? Do you know in the scripture, Jesus never submitted himself to any formula? Jesus, do you ever notice he never healed the same way twice? One person, he touches their eyes. Another person, he spits in the mud. Another person, he sends them off to healing. I mean, to be healed on the way to show themselves the priest. He didn't have a healing line. There was nothing you could count on to be the formula for following this. He didn't let it happen on purpose, I'm convinced of it. He refuses to be part of a formula. If you're a pastor and you're following a church growth formula, forget it. You're going to have a fleshly effort because I don't believe you can put together all the Bible principles and create the formula that's going to do it. No, it's about total trust in God, not in yourself and you keeping a formula. And I was trusting myself and my wife was trusting herself and this formula. We will forget that our children are self-determining individuals. They're people. They're not projects. They're not chemicals that we mix into a formula. They're not chemicals we mix into a cake. They're not dogs. They're people. So here's what happens. I want to give you this 5-step problem, all right, that creates problems in our homes. The more we focus on formulas and principles, the more children become things. I'd go home, here's the new principle, here's the new thing we're going to do. My kids used to take bets with each other, how long will this one last for mom and dad? They would have a betting pool going on. How long are mom and dad going to try this one? But it's like the kids were just things. How they felt was insignificant. What they were thinking. Now, mind you, these are teenagers at home. But how they felt, their opinions, their wishes, didn't matter. I'm in charge. Here's what I've said. This is God's plan. Receive my decision. I'm the patriarch here. Just receive it. formulas, principles, the kids became things. Get this, the more they become things, the less we as parents have significant relationship with our kids. You don't need relationship with somebody who's just, it's all right, I'm just doing a thing on you, doing a parenting process. God will honor it. Number three, the less we have relationship then, the more we lose their hearts. The more they may be, yes, Mom, yes, Dad, outwardly. But the less we have that relationship, the more we're going to lose their hearts. Number four, and without their hearts, the less we're able to influence their values. The less we're able to influence their values without their hearts. Yeah, and you need to influence their values in their teen years. Number five, and without their hearts, the best we can do is control the outside. Right? For a while. You can control it just for a little while. But that's about it. Don't be happy with controlling the outside. You're not controlling the heart by controlling the outer decisions. Let me give you, just in brief, some basic solutions to the problems. These are not going to be thorough enough. I really want to encourage you to get the full set that I'm speaking from here. But here's some things, if you have to put into practice, here's some recommendations. First, letter A, cease making your family into a trophy. 1 John 5:21 tells us to keep ourselves from idols. Don't make your family a trophy or an idol. Cast it down. Get rid of the idol of the family. Stop elevating it. Because the family as an idol is a thing. And you sacrifice, idols require sacrifice. You know what happens when you elevate family and make a family an idol? You've made it like equal to the gospel. Like the family is my reputation and my reputation of success. Sacrifice, you sacrifice your children to the idol of the family. It's about them. It's not about your reputation as a parent in a home that's done everything right. Come on, who do you respond best to? You personally. You respond best to people who know you exist and who love you. You as an adult, your teens are no different. Your kids are no different. They're begging for connection with mom and dad. They're not a thing to be done a parenting thing on. So cease making your family an idol. Number one, in your heart, give God the glory for your children's good behavior. Stop crediting yourself. Stop crediting your methods. People want to know how to raise good kids. That's fine. Tell them what you do know. But don't glory in yourself. Say, thank you, Father, you've honored my efforts. It's very nice, Father. You've blessed my efforts to sow good seed into my kids. But God, you're the one. I sow, another waters. It's God who gives the increase. 1 Corinthians 3:6. God gives that increase. Stop crediting yourself. Next, you can tell your family's a trophy if you're choosing other people's opinions over your children. So here's my son. He's 18 years old. He's booted from the home. He lives with his friends, puts a sofa on the floor. Get this, though. The first thing he did was go to a pawn shop and buy himself a TV video VCR combo for $50. And then he rented every movie we'd ever forbid him to watch. All those years of sheltering lost in 2 months. Thoroughly polluted. So, and we wept every night, an hour. And so 4 months later, we're up at Tahoe. Our life was so shaken when this happened. We took a sabbatical to Tahoe for a couple months away from the church. We're at Tahoe just kind of reconnecting as a family. And then we invite our son to join us. He comes and ends up renewing his life heart to the Lord there. And he says, you know what, I've got some new friends in Sacramento that aren't good influence on me. I wish I could be someplace else. We said, how about Tahoe? So he stayed there, joined a little church that we were connecting with, and ended up staying there, keeping his walk with the Lord. But during that time, that season, he got some tattoos. You see, they had some rock and rollers who get saved, and then they would take their obscene tattoos and turn them into Christian tattoos. And so my son had always wanted to be cool by certain groups of people, and that was going to work just fine. So first time I saw him, his first tattoo was a crown of thorns on his bicep, peeking out from under his T-shirt. We were visiting Tahoe at the time. I said, what's that? And he says, oh, I didn't know you could see it. I can see it. Just tell me it's rub-on. And he says, completely contrary to the value system we'd sought to give him. I mean, it makes no sense to me in my brain. But he says, Dad, I've been flaky with God in the past. I didn't want to be flaky again. So I wanted a reminder of his suffering for me. And I got a crown of thorns to remind me of that so I don't flake out on God again. And all I could think was, oh, he's got a good excuse. He says, I was hoping you'd help me and tell me what verse to put under it. How about the one in Leviticus that says, don't tattoo your body? You could put that right there. My son, if you see him this day, he's 32 now. He has tattoos on both sides, Christian tattoos, and one from his ankle to his knee. And so he calls me a year later and says, Dad, I've been trying to go to the police academy here. It's not working. He says, I can't make a living, work full-time, go to the academy. It's just not working. Can I move home? I said, well, sure, son, absolutely. We want to help you. Just, you know, the deal. You move home. He'd gotten the ears pierced in the meantime. He can't have the earrings. Got to cover the tattoos at church. I can't have people saying, grow up and be like the pastor's son. And he says, never mind. Okay. So a few months later, he calls me back. He says, Dad, I really have to come home. I said, you know the deal, the arrangement. He says, no sweat. The Lord spoke to me about the earrings. They've been gone for a couple months. And I said, well, come on home. He came home. Folks, I made a serious mistake because ultimately I said, I choose people's opinion of me over you and who you are. I don't get tattoos personally. If you have them, they're part of you. I will accept and embrace that, and I might even admire the artwork. But so I can't personally relate to permanent art like that, but this is my son. This is my son. And I said, I choose people's opinion of me over you. Does that, you follow what's wrong with that? If it were to happen again, I'd say, come on home, and if people leave the church, it's okay. I was thinking of getting a mohawk to weed out the judges anyway. You see, if my son showed up here at this event in tank top and shorts, he wouldn't embarrass me. It wouldn't. This is my son. He is my son, and he's made choices that are different from mine. But he wouldn't embarrass me at all. He would have 10 years ago, but he wouldn't now, because I accept him for exactly who he is and the choices he's made. I don't embrace them or understand them, but it's who he is. I accept all of who he is. I don't get excited about it, but it is who he is. So therefore, I accept him as that. This is an important principle to get. That is what alienated me from my kids for so long. I was choosing other people's opinion over my children. Letter B, I don't want to run out of time here. Invest more in their hearts than into changing the expressions of their hearts. Clean the inside of the cup. Remember, invest more into the hearts than just don't wear that, don't dress like that. Spend time, whether in the Word or cultivating your relationship, talking about your heart. Go on walks with them, talk to them, share them your weaknesses. Be a fellow Christian to them and talk about their struggles. I do. I go to my kids and say, I'm sorry, I'm really bad at this. I'm suspicious and judgmental, and I'm suspicious and judgmental of you guys, and you don't deserve it. I did it again last night when I jumped all over you for doing such and such. I'm sorry about that. That's just sharing heart. It's being real. Letter C. Guard yourself against a judgmental spirit. Listen to yourself. The scriptures you can look at on your own, on your sheets there. But listen to yourself when you have a judgmental heart, when you're condescending and belittling others. Beware, Lord, I'm taking pride in something here. Forgive me. Cry out to God for humility, number one, under C. Cry out to God for humility, especially when you spot any judgmental tendency in yourself. In fact, some children are looking for affirmation when they judge others. Number two, coach your children towards humility and love when they manifest judgment. Say, did you see so-and-so? Did you see what they were? Did you see how the children didn't obey their parents the first time? Those parents had to call them three times. Looking for you to pat them on the head. I know, they're not all as enlightened as us and as obedient as you. No, you look at them and say, yeah, parents need help. We all need help. I don't know what my blind spots are. But whatever you do, reaffirm to your children that they will never get your pat on the head for criticizing and judging others, because they probably learned it from listening to you judge others. And they just want you to pat them on the head and say, you get it too. Make humility, make love the pillar of your home. Letter D, cultivate a relationship of love with your children, where you love them. When I figured this out, my oldest son, or my second son, who's 26, he was about 15, about 11 years ago, I guess. I remember thinking, I don't have a relationship with him. He's 15. What do? You go fishing together? I didn't realize it was about trust. You cultivate a relationship by being someone that's trustworthy. All I knew how to be was domineering and controlling and wise, saying wise things. But that didn't glean trust. You want a relationship of love with your kids? Number one, see your children as people, not as projects. They're people. They're worth listening to. Doesn't mean you allow them to be mouthy and talk back and sass. It means that if they say to you respectfully, can we talk about this? You say, certainly. Or it means you sit down and say, we're talking about where to go to dinner tonight. What are your thoughts before we go? It doesn't mean you just completely say, your opinion is nothing to us. See your children as people, not as projects. And this is going to require, number two, that you drink continually from God's well of love so that you have plenty to spill on to your children. Jesus was attractive. He was amazingly attractive. You ever thought about it? He was like a beacon light that could show the darkness in every corner of your life. How frightening is that? To be with somebody who can see right through. Come on, you know people like that. It's frightening that they look at you and they can see everything about you and you know it. And you feel naked in front of them every time you interact with them. And some of you, you're like that and people are afraid of you and you like that. Shame on us if that's us. No, that's... Jesus had this ability to look into people and look right through them, but there was something about him. You know what it was about him? He had a way of not condemning. He would say, I see right through you, but I like you. He'd want you to repent, but there was something about him that the worst of sinners would say, I like this one. The woman at the well, he'd look right through her, but yet she ran to town and said, come see the man who looked right through me and told me everything I've ever done. That was a scary man to me, but apparently not scary because he accepted me. I felt it. Makes me want to repent of my life. Folks, love, real love, woos the hearts of those under us if you really love your kids rather than just impatient. When are you going to become? When are you going to grow? Where they look into our eyes, what do they see when they see our eyes? Frustration, suspicion, mistrust. Your eyes reveal your heart. I used to have to discipline myself to smile at my children. I used to practice in front of a mirror. I'm not kidding. Smiling, and the eyes have to go too. Hey, hi kids. Hey. Hi, guys. After a week, the kids said, what's with Dad? Their mom says, oh, they changed his medication. No, I was just practicing, showing them the love that was in my heart because my kids were used to suspicion and mistrust. Folks, there's so much more I could say in this. We don't have time today. How to cultivate relationship. I can give you help later, but tonight, let me suffice it with those things. Just keep this in mind. When they look into your eyes, they must see acceptance and delight. They've got to know they're accepted and loved. Some of you have learned to squint and scrunch and look suspiciously at your children, and they feel it. You'll lose that one because they'll give up. They'll give up trying to patronize you. Go to them and say, I've had a scrunching problem. And I'm repenting of it because I love you. And you don't see it when you look into my eyes. All you see is suspicion and mistrust. And I love you, but you don't feel it. I am so sorry. You'll blow your kid's mind, but that's being honest, isn't it? Hey, that's kind of like getting trust because you're being real. That's important that our kids have that with us. Final point, make it your top goal to understand and live out the gospel in your home. This is worthy of a whole session. I can't give it now. It's in that set I was telling you about. Make it your top goal. Malachi 4:6 says, John the Baptist was going to come. It's a prophecy about him. He's going to come. He's going to turn the hearts of the fathers, children, and the hearts of the children of their fathers. Get this, folks. John the Baptist came and preached. I studied every word he ever said, everything about him. Do you know that he never once mentioned parents or children? Not one time. How did he fulfill this? Do you know what he did do? He says, look to the Lamb of God. Here's the Lamb of God who's going to take away the sin of the world. He was in the gospel that he preached. He knew that if people really, really understood and appropriated that the Lamb of God was going to take away their sins, it would change who they were, and therefore it was going to do something. Men who were self-absorbed wouldn't just be signing up for a church and joining the deacon's board. They would be changed who they were, and it would change how they relate with their kids. And they'll turn the hearts of self-absorbed men towards their children, and children respond. The gospel would be powerful. Folks, sometimes we just don't know the gospel. We know the plan of salvation, we can repeat it. But to know and enjoy the gospel as John the Baptist preached it, to really know it changes who we are. And therefore, the faith we have, it's contagious, is caught by our kids. It's not just something we put on them right after math. Not something we just teach them in Bible lessons. It's about who we are. Folks, I really want to, we don't have any more time, we're out of time. If you want to get more help, listen, here's the set I've been talking about. Please get the full message. I want to see you help. This is my investment in the next generation of homeschoolers. God bless you guys.